This is the Context Podcast. Context Magazine is a publication of the American Sociological Association.
In this episode, we talk with Jennifer Silva, research fellow at Harvard University. Her book, Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty, examines how working class young men and women navigate the transition to adulthood in a climate of job insecurity, family instability, and deepening inequality. Today, we talk about her new piece in the spring 2014 issue of Context Magazine called Working Class Growing Pains. Welcome to the Context Podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
Let's talk about your new piece where you begin with someone named Diana's story. So who is Diana and how does her situation kind of describe the transition to adulthood and how that's been changing?
So Diana is actually the first interview that I conducted. She's a 24-year-old young woman who is still living at home with her mother and who is trying to figure out what it means to be an adult. She can't really figure out if she's still a teenager or if she's made the transition to adulthood. And that's because for Diana, becoming an adult means moving out of her mom's house, getting a great job, finishing school, and then getting married and even having kids. But Diana, unfortunately, tried to go to college but ended up dropping out because her loans were too scary for her. She was something like $80,000 in debt, and she couldn't really, you know, figure out what she wanted to do with her degree. And then, you know, so now she's selling coffee and making about $275 a week, so she can't move out of her mother's house. And at the same time, she hasn't really found, you know, a guy with a good job who treats her well to date. So she hasn't really accomplished any of the markers of adulthood that she identifies. So she's someone in limbo. And, you know, Diana is not alone. She embodies this delayed transition to adulthood that many young men and women today are facing, where, you know, the kind of stable markers of getting married and getting a job and finishing school are out of reach. So they're trying to figure out, okay, well, you know, have I grown up yet?
Mm-hmm. So after Diana, you went out and interviewed 100 working class young adults. And in your piece, you write that it was profoundly alarming. So in general, what kind of stuff were you hearing?
It really was profoundly alarming. You know, young adults today, they just seem stuck. They believe in the American dream. They want to grow up. They want to get good jobs and support their families and, you know, make something of themselves. But it seems like at every turn, they encounter some kind of obstacle that keeps them from moving ahead in life. And what we see is that they're really losing faith in the American dream. They're starting to feel kind of hopeless. Mm-hmm. To give you a good example, there's one young woman I interviewed named Rachel, who has a son, and Rachel wants to provide the best life possible for her son. So aside from working 40 hours a week in customer service, she joins the National Guard because she thinks the Army will pay for me to go to college and I can create a better life for my son. However, she has ended up, you know, deploying twice to Afghanistan. So she's had to leave her son behind. And when she comes back, she's so busy, you know, being a full-time parent and working full-time that she doesn't even have time to go to school anyway. And at the same time, you know, she'd love to have, you know, a father for her kid, but she can't seem to meet the right person. So it's like at every time these young adults try to do something to make their lives better, they keep hitting this wall where it's really hard to get ahead.
Mm-hmm. You also tie this into how this is changing what we think of as very entrenched social institutions. So one example that comes out in your piece is the institution of family. So how is that changing?
Yes, that's right. So kind of at the root of the book, I would say, is this focus on economic changes and the ways in which, you know, being working class has really changed in the last 30 or 40 years, so that working class jobs don't pay very much. They don't have great benefits. And so what that means is that young men, especially who have this vision of being a provider in a family, they can't achieve that goal. They can't make enough money to, you know, move out of their own house and get an apartment, or they can't make enough money to, you know, even take someone out to dinner. And so a lot of the men I spoke with have kind of lost faith in long-term commitment because they say, you know, no woman wants to sit around the house and eat Burger King. Like, if I can't take care of a family, I have to stay single.
Right.
And there's this nostalgia, like, you know, they say, I always thought I'd, you know, grow up and buy a little house and sit on the porch with my wife. But that's gone now. And for women, you know, they say, you know, it seems kind of risky to commit to a partner because they've worked really hard to get where they are. They know that they have to rely on themselves. And so it becomes very difficult to imagine, you know, risking all of that on a relationship that might not work out.
Right. And then you also discuss how this is changing higher education. So what did you hear in your interviews about college and higher ed?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So most of the people I spoke with really believe in college as the way to get ahead in life. It's not like they reject a college degree. Most of them really want one. But what happens is while they know that they should go to college, it becomes very difficult to figure out how to go to college, how to get into college, how to figure out financial aid and the FAFSA, how to choose a major, how to do well in their classes, and then ultimately how to use a degree if they get one to get a good job. And so, you know, they look to higher education as sort of this institution that's supposed to help them or that is supposed to give them the tools to success. But then in most of their encounters with higher education, they end up feeling very betrayed. So maybe they will try to fill out, you know, the FAFSA and they don't understand it, or their parents won't give them their financial aid information. And so they end up not being able to pay for college or taking out huge loans. You know, maybe they end up switching majors several times and, you know, can't decide what to major in and have trouble envisioning, you know, how a degree will relate to a job. So they give up. And still others who actually get four-year degrees end up working in the service economy because they don't have the connections or knowledge to take that degree and get, you know, a professional middle-class job. Right. And so education, I think more than any other social institution, symbolizes this betrayal mm-hmm. or like a false promise or broken promise.
And that's definitely a theme that seems to have come up a lot as sort of, I think you describe it as one incident of deception after another. So how did your interviewees talk about this sort of sense of being deceived?
They described sort of this pathway of being betrayed by every single institution that they tried to navigate in the transition to adulthood. So their stories are about kind of expecting an institution to work with them and then feeling kind of shut down or betrayed. And so you see that kind of in the family where, you know, people have grown up in somewhat chaotic or difficult family lives because their parents are also kind of suffering from our economy. You know, they grow up in families where their parents are very stressed out about paying bills or maybe unable to keep a house or suffering from disability but not having enough health care or medical care to help them make ends meet. And then they kind of go to school and they have many stories about, you know, not understanding what was going on in terms of material at school or, you know, trying to go to college but not being able to pay for it or figure it out. Some of them talk about joining the military for the bonus, but then finding that they don't get their bonus payment all at once, but instead spread over 8 years. So it was kind of like a false promise again. Mm-hmm. So it's really just, you know, they really tell the story of one incident after another, you know, even if it's, you know, paying rent in an apartment and feeling like their roommates cheated them. Mm-hmm. And there's this great story. I interviewed this guy who talked about, you know, getting phone calls from, you know, magazine companies saying, do you want a free subscription to this magazine? And they say yes. And then all of a sudden they're being billed for it every month and are not sure how that happened. And their credit's, you know, getting worse. And so it's just this idea that they don't have the skills and knowledge to just navigate everyday life. And that makes them feel very isolated and very distrustful because they start to say, well, obviously I shouldn't trust anyone. I shouldn't put myself on the line. No one's going to take care of me but me. And if I want to be okay in life, I can't trust or depend on anyone.
And at the end of your piece, you kind of get into sort of what I saw as a complex coping mechanism that really highlights the tension between these sort of social or institutional barriers and then our own sense of individual efficacy. So what was this process and how did your interviewees talk about that?
It's really interesting because when I began the interviews, I expected them to talk about the economy a lot and maybe politics. So I was expecting people to say, you know, I hate that I can't afford healthcare, or, you know, my job doesn't pay me enough to make ends meet, or higher education should be less expensive. And they did say that a little bit, but I was shocked that most of them focused pretty intensely on their own personal struggles to, you know, overcome difficult relationships or battle, you know, a mental illness like depression, or maybe deal with an addiction. And so even like, you know, these men who I expected to be much more traditionally masculine and stoic started telling me these very long stories about personal suffering and their struggles to kind of fix themselves or deal with their emotional pain and move on. So for example, someone might say, I had a really difficult relationship with my father. I felt like he betrayed me by leaving. That's made it really hard for me in life. And so I've had to really fix myself and focus on my own emotional turmoil. And I started to think about this in terms of telling a narrative of growing up or making progress. So they can't really say, oh, look, I graduated from high school and I went to college and I got a great job and I got married and bought a house, because those markers are all totally unavailable to them. And so what it looks like to me is that they're instead focusing on inward growth. For example, I had to battle, you know, long-standing depression and fix myself. Or I had to go to NA meetings and figure out how not to drink anymore or use drugs anymore and become a better person. And for me, you know, I think it's great that they're finding some sense of meaning in their lives, but it also means that they're telling profoundly personal stories about what it means to grow up, maybe not paying much attention to the kinds of structural barriers that stand in their way.
And, you know, after you read this piece, it becomes apparent that these are, you know, deep structural barriers. And sometimes it's difficult for us to try to figure out how to kind of fix these things. But after you've done this research, do you envision any kind of specific local level shifts or changes in the way that education or something like that is run that might change this for young people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I know the piece kind of ends on a depressing note. but I think that at the local level, we could think about creating new forms of community or social support. So one of the big problems that many of these young adults face is that they don't really have the knowledge they need to navigate social institutions and try to create a better life for themselves. And so I would think maybe if we had some kind of mentoring or guidance where, you know, they had someone in the community who could say, you know, this is how you fill out the FAFSA, or this is a better choice when it comes to going to college than this college. Or, you know, let me introduce you to someone who might be able to tell you how to use your degree in communication to get a job. And so for me, I guess it's kind of rebuilding social institutions so that these young adults become a little bit more trustful and can reach out for some guidance.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for talking with us. This is Jennifer Silva, and her new piece will be in the next issue of Context Magazine. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
This is